Welcome to Podcast 6, Immigration, Race, and Labor in Argentina and Brazil. My name is Dr. Benjamin Bryce, and this is History 281, Republican Latin America at the University of Northern British Columbia. Today I'm going to talk about 4 points. First, I want to talk about and have us think about immigration as a transformative experience for Brazil and Argentina in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Then to talk briefly about the push and pull factors causing transatlantic migration from Europe in particular to the Americas, broadly speaking. And then I want to zoom in on 2 examples about immigration, race, and labor in Brazil and Argentina. First, talking about the relationship between the end of slavery and the beginning of mass migration to Brazil. And in the case of Argentina, as a case study to talk about government and nationalist reactions to a growingly, increasingly diverse population, and this history of nationalist reaction, though it could also be applied in other parts of the Americas, and Argentina in this case is very much a case study. So first, to my first point on transformation, there are 4 main destinations for transatlantic migrants in the Americas between about 1880 and 1930, which is talked about by historians as this sort of moment of mass migration. It really picks up steam in the 1880s, and then with the onset of the Great Depression in 1929, there's a massive decline. Depression plus World War II, there's sort of a major slowing of international migration as a result. Or after 1930, and that doesn't pick up again until the late 1940s and into the 1950s. So in this context, these 4 major destinations, the United States receives about 30 million immigrants in this time period, this 50-year period from 1880 to 1930. Argentina is the second most common destination, receiving about 6 million transatlantic migrants, and Canada close behind at 5.5 million, and Brazil close behind at about 4 million. So the latter 3, Argentina, Canada, and Brazil, are all fairly similar in terms of how many people are coming to their new people are arriving in the country in this 50-year period, and the United States stands out. But an important takeaway from that is that rather than thinking of national particularity with the United States or sort of some sort of Anglo-North American particularity, there's another place in the Americas that is in many ways equally attractive, equally attractive as another pole of transatlantic migration. That is Brazil and Argentina as sort of a southern cone hub in relation to also then the eastern seaboard and of the United States, the Midwest, and in places like Ontario and the Canadian and American plains. This mass migration of about 50 million people has a significant impact on population growth. These countries boom in terms of overall size. Argentina and at the start of this period has about 2 million people, and at the end of this period has about 8 million people. The same could be said about Canada. So the arrival of new people, in addition to other demographic changes in the country, in these countries themselves, leads to a massive population growth in parts of the Americas up until then had not been as populous. It's also a broader population shift in the Atlantic world. If in 1800, as percentage of world population, the Americas has far fewer people than other parts of the world, by 1900, that's no longer the case. All of a sudden, America has become, particularly certain regions of the Americas, the sort of North America and Southern Cone, become very populous areas. This coincides with and drives and plays an important role in urbanization. So cities grow immensely in size, particularly in these countries that we're talking about today, Brazil and Argentina, as well as Canada and the United States. And I'll give you an example of particular Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo and Rio to talk about this massive transformation of cities because of immigration. They coincide with and then also drive an economic boom. It is because there is more and more economic opportunity that these countries become increasingly attractive for transatlantic labor migrants. And as a result, also, there's even more economic growth. At the same time, the sort of the outcome of all of this migration is that for a very long period of time, in mid-20th century, these are societies of cultural pluralism. That's sort of an academic word to talk about multiculturalism, which is sort of more also in the modern sense as a relationship with state policies. But these are culturally plural societies. They are linguistically diverse, religiously diverse. People's identities are diverse. People have strong interests in other parts of the world. They have increasing involvement with multiple communities. This is as a result of this influx of a lot of people from other places. This cultural pluralism can be seen in all sorts of ways. The language is spoken on streets. Foreign language newspapers emerge in all of these, in cities of even small cities and mid-sized cities and these large cities across the Americas where migrants are going. Immigrants form things like mutual aid societies, so they're sort of urban social organization along ethnic lines and then offering, in this case, social services along ethnic lines. There's all sorts of leisure activities that are created, again, along ethnic lines, and these are markers of a culturally pluralist society. So sports associations, social groups, immigrants get increasingly involved in education and sort of with an interest in using schools to foster or maintain that cultural pluralism in the societies in which they've migrated to, and in particular with a strong interest in fostering bilingualism in the children of immigrants and encouraging that their immigrants are interested in encouraging that their children speak the language of their parents and of their families and of their communities. As I mentioned already, there's religious diversity and hybrid identities and transnational connections. So people living in, say, Buenos Aires also take interest in, write letters to, read news about people living in Italy, people living in Syria, people living in Germany. These are these transnational connections that are another feature or marker of a culturally plural society. So in this transformation and in Brazil, speaking specifically, as I mentioned in the last podcast, in 1871, there's a marked decline in slavery with this law of the free womb. All children born to enslaved women after 1871 are born free people, and as a result, slavery slowly declines. It's phased out in this gradual emancipation. And at the same time, immigration rates are increasing. This is in part because of these broader economic transformations taking place in Brazil. There are still workers needed in rural agriculture. And while, of course, then freed slaves can also work in rural agriculture, as this economy is expanding, there's more and more demand for workers. And as a result, the government and the Brazilian government and planters attempt to attract new labor to fill these voids, and in the context of not being able to rely on the old system of labor that existed up until then. So in the case of Brazil, there's all sorts of government schemes to attract Chinese, German, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, Japanese laborers to work in Brazilian agriculture. What ends up often happening is while people start off in Brazilian agriculture, they often then move to Brazilian cities instead. But the original attempt of sort of maintaining an agricultural society reliant though on new workers imported through transatlantic or trans-Pacific migration is intimately connected to the end of slavery. One way that you can see this in the role of the government in fostering this new kind of immigration and in the timing that the government is also playing an important role in phasing out slavery. In the case of immigrants to Sao Paulo, which is the main destination for immigrants to Brazil, the state and city of Sao Paulo, between 1890 and 1930, about half of all fares on transatlantic steamers are subsidized by the government. So as a way to encourage immigrants to come, their fare is being subsidized to make Brazil a more attractive destination vis-a-vis other places where people could be going, such as Argentina or Canada or the United States. So of these about 4 million immigrants to Brazil between 1880 and 1930, 58% go to just the city and the state of Sao Paulo. And as a result, Sao Paulo is absolutely transformed. There's a massive demographic boom in this time period. At the beginning of this period, so my marker here is 1872, there are 31,000 inhabitants of Sao Paulo. It's a small town, a fairly peripheral part in Brazilian society. In 1920, Sao Paulo has 830,000 people. And in 1940, it's doubled in size to 1.6 million people. It is now today one of the biggest cities in the world with over 20 million people. That city of 20 million people, which was already a big city in 1940 with 1.6 million people, and in 1920 with 830,000 people, in 1872 had 31,000 people. There's a similar transformation of Rio. Rio starts off a bit bigger. It was the important center of power in the colonial period in early and mid-19th century. So by 1872, Rio has 275,000 people, so much bigger than Sao Paulo. and a fair-sized city for the world in 1872. But by 1940, it has 1.7 million people. So again, a massive urbanization is taking place in these two Brazilian cities, and immigration is playing an important role in that population boom and transformation of where population, where people live. So not just being an agricultural society, but also a very urban society. So a key idea driving Brazilian immigration policies, and this is actually something you could say about immigration policies elsewhere in Latin America in particular, is that there's this goal by elites and government officials to Europeanize Brazilian society. There's this belief that by importing European people, European bodies, they'll also import all sorts of European ideas of ways of social organization, transform democracies and economies and work and all sorts of things, and sort of replace the colonial vestiges, in this case in Brazil, the colonial vestiges of slavery. And so to modernize Brazilian society, they will Europeanize themselves, and they will whiten their population by importing foreign European bodies, and sort of demographically offset the pre-existing balance between slavery or post-slavery and a small white elite. Now, while on the one hand, the Brazilian elites talk very positively about European immigration in an abstract way, they also often treat immigrants, once they arrive, as these servile laborers that are in many ways a problem and not actually the agents of development. So they are talked about very positively in some conversations, often in comparison to former slaves, but then in other conversations, and once there's actually, when they're actually talking about European laborers now living in Brazil, there's actually a lot more concern or critique of them instead. So these are sort of two kinds of elite fantasies about both the benefits and problems of European immigration. European immigrants, once they find themselves in Brazil, working particularly on plantations, find the working conditions very difficult, and soon after arriving, there's a very high number of immigrants who then migrate onwards to either Brazilian cities or actually often also on to Argentina, seeking better labor conditions. Once in Brazil, and also you can say the same thing about Argentina and elsewhere in the Americas, European immigrants become very active in labor movements and sort of fighting for workers' rights, and this is in many ways in response to these elite fantasies about the problems that workers bring or the way that workers should be behaving, and then the reality is that workers have other opinions about that. One thing that makes connects Argentina to this Brazilian fantasy of replacing slaves with European agricultural laborers is that the wages in Argentina are higher. So then when workers are unhappy in Brazilian plantations and they flee to cities or to Argentina, one reason they're going to Argentina also is they can get better wages for their work there. Buenos Aires, the city, the Argentine capital, is similarly transformed in this period of mass migration, undergoing an actually even more spectacular boom in population compared to Sao Paulo. So in 1869, Buenos Aires is a city of 177,000 people, a very peripheral part of Spanish America compared to other parts of Spanish America with longer colonial histories, such as Lima or Mexico City. But by 1936, there are 2.4 million people living in Buenos Aires. Its population increases 13-fold in this time period. In 1914, Buenos Aires is the second largest city on the Atlantic seaboard of the Americas. And in 1914, 50% of the population of that city are foreign-born. And if you factor in both foreign-born and the children of foreign-born people, that is actually about 70% of the city's population is first or second generation immigrant. So this is a city fundamentally shaped by immigration and defined by its cultural pluralism in the early 20th century. The biggest group of immigrants to come to Argentina this time period are Italians. Between 1876 and 1914, about 1.8 million Italians come. There are a bit over a million Spaniards who come, but of the 6 million immigrants to come to the country, there's a very long list of places of origin, and then in national memory or mythology about immigration, Italians and Spaniards stand out, and it is true that they made up somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of immigrants, depending on how big your time frame is. But that other one-third of immigrants who aren't Italian or Spanish that's also a very big block of people. And one thing I also do in my own research is emphasize the importance of thinking beyond just these big two groups, because you can also learn a lot about a society by not focusing on just who the number one group is or who the number two group is, but also thinking more broadly about the nature of a country's or a city's cultural pluralism. Moving on to point number two, I want to talk about the push and pull factors of migration. This is something that can also applies today. And thinking about what causes people to come and go, and it's definitely not just, you know, elite policies about let's replace slaves with European laborers. That would be a very simple explanation of why people are going to Brazil and Argentina. And also, if you think, because there's plenty of other examples in the Americas, say Bolivia or Guatemala, where there's similar elite fantasies about the need to import European laborers, when that doesn't, and that does not lead to a reality. So there's more things involved in this story than just government officials or a president or an author declaring the need for more immigration. So what causes emigration from Europe or elsewhere, other parts of the world? Well, poverty is sort of a typical in sort of people's personal stories of why people left a different part of the world. The economic conditions elsewhere are worse than where they are now, and so that was a driving factor. But one thing that's really interesting when you look at transatlantic migration in this time period is that the people leaving those societies, whether it's Italy or the Ukraine or England or Syria, the people leaving those societies are not actually the poorest members of those societies. They are people that actually have a certain amount of, not affluence, but a certain amount of financial wherewithal and financial means, so they can pay for a transatlantic voyage. They might also know someone who's already embarked on that transatlantic voyage, which is perhaps also another marker of a certain amount of access to economic resources. And also, the major countries of immigration are not the poorest countries. So if you look at the list of European countries sending people to other parts of the world, it is Italy, Germany, and England. Those are not the three poorest countries in Europe, and yet those are the three biggest senders of people. So the industrialization of parts of those countries, workers' involvement in industrialization, workers' and connections to networks and transatlantic voyages and things like that is allowing them to migrate, and not the poverty in their country. So why are more people leaving Italy or Germany than they are Romania? Well, it's because, in fact, that is not the poorest place, and that's what's, in fact, not being poor is what's causing transatlantic immigration. The stories of war or repression and fleeing violence, well, of course, is important in very specific moments of migration. If you look broadly at the statistics of about 50 million people crossing the Atlantic Ocean in this time period from 1880 to 1930, the vast majority of those people are not fleeing war and repression. And again, the places people are leaving from, such as Italy, Germany, and England, are all places where there wasn't a great deal of war and repression in this time period. Now, countries having pro-immigration policies is an important precursor in allowing millions of people then to come. Another way of saying it might be not having anti-immigration policies, so sort of states' indifference or mild encouragement of immigration is often enough, so they don't need to be actively subsidizing passages on transatlantic voyages, like in the case of Sao Paulo, to be attracting immigrants. But that said, countries across the Americas from Mexico to Bolivia all had pro-immigration policies, and yet those are not main destinations for transatlantic migrants. So what's really driving all of this migration to particularly four countries, or these two regions of the Americas, North America and the Southern Cone of South America, are high wages, economic opportunities in industry and farming, and just broader industrialization and economic interests. The people who are involved in transatlantic migration most are those who are also in contact with industrialization and industrial wage labor in Europe. So people in urban areas of Europe are more likely leaving than people in isolated rural areas of those same countries. People's proximity to ports, proximity to steamships, access to technological improvements afforded by things like steamships or the train that gets you to a steamship is all driving people's transatlantic migration. Now, moving on to my third point, slavery and immigration in Brazil. I want to zoom in on this one case and how, in the case of Brazil specifically, the end of slavery, this gradual emancipation from the 1870s onwards, is intimately connected to immigration in Brazil, and that way, the ways that Brazilians talk about immigration in several decades after the beginning of emancipation in 1871 in Brazil. So immigration in the late 19th century is about work, and as I just mentioned, it's about seeking economic opportunity. It's about the rapidly expanding economies and the growing need for workers. In the case of Brazil, the growing need for workers is also intimately tied to the end of slavery. So for government policymakers and people who own large agricultural estates, expanding agricultural industrial production is something that should be done by is seen as something that should be done by imported laborers and not by former slaves. Now, race is something that's a central theme in Brazil and connected to immigration, and the fact that there's this project and desire to import Europeans at the same time that they are transforming the way that enslaved Africans are engaging work in Brazil shows how race is so central in understanding labor and immigration in that country. The biggest groups, and not to dwell on lists of the biggest groups, as I just mentioned, in the case of Argentina, but similarly to Argentina, Italians and Spaniards are two major groups. Italy and Spain are two major sources of immigrants to Brazil. So of the 4 million people that come in this before the Second World War, there's about 1.6 million Italian immigrants and 700,000 Spanish immigrants. Unlike Argentina, and actually unlike a lot of other parts of the Americas, there's also 1.5 million Portuguese immigrants to Brazil, which makes one of the fewer Portuguese immigrants aren't emigrating. Portuguese people are emigrating a lot less than people from elsewhere in Europe, and the number one place they're going to is Brazil. They speak the same language. There's a lot of historic connections, trade ties, affinities between the two countries. There's also a few other groups that stand out in Brazil, and I want to zoom in on them for a second. One is that starting in 1908, and there's actually a correlation between this start and closing of borders in North America, but starting in 1908, Brazil becomes an important destination for Japanese migrants, and between 1908 and 1936, about 175,000 Japanese immigrate to Brazil, and Brazil is increasingly opening its borders at the same time the United States and Canada are closing their borders to East Asian migrants from Japan and China. And these Japanese immigrants, as well as Arabic-speaking immigrants from the Eastern Mediterranean, from present-day Syria and Lebanon, complicate racial categories in Brazil. And if immigration is being seen as something in direct relation to the end of slavery, it's the immigration of Europeans that is playing a role in the end of slavery and the transformation of Brazilian society. Well, the arrival of Japanese and Arabic-speaking peoples kind of complicates a simple white-black binary that had played an important role in Brazilian understandings of race during the period of slavery. So in general, these two groups of immigrants, Arabs and Japanese, are embraced as desirable immigrants, or they're examples of discrimination, but in general they are seen in a positive light and as something that will help this Brazilian project in transforming the society through international immigration. So Japanese in particular are sort of fetishized or idealized as the perfect migrants. Japan as a country is a model for prosperity. It's a model for modernization and transformation. It's a country from the mid-19th century onwards rapidly changing itself, and this is then seen by Brazilian elites as a possible model for Brazil, and as a result, immigrants from that country then are necessarily seen as some helpful source of modernization. In the minds of Brazilian elites, again, as I was talking about earlier, fundamentally connected to an agricultural economy, Japanese workers are imagined as docile workers and sort of subservient to the demands of plantation owners. In a sense, they'll be a helpful labor replacement in a post-slave society. It'll be these docile workers that will allow elites to maintain their privilege and exploitation of workers. Now, that's not true, but that's how they're being imagined by Brazilian elites talking about immigration in this time period. And what in many ways is true is that Japanese migrants appear to be willing and prove to be willing to work in agriculture, which is something that Brazilian elites are frustrated with about European migrants, that many come to plantations or agricultural zones and then migrate onto cities. Conversely, a lot of Japanese end up spending a lot more time in rural areas. So in the case of Arab immigration, and also talking about Jewish immigration, either from the Middle East or from Eastern Europe, Brazilian elites also, especially the Arab, Arabic-speaking migrants, Brazilian elites try to reconcile this with their broader project of Europeanizing society. And one way the Brazilian elites do this is start talking about the European connection, or the Europeanness of Arabs, in a sense. And so they talk about how Portugal, a European country, the country from which Brazil comes, was in fact a country with a long history before, up until the 15th and 16th centuries, with large Arab and Jewish populations. And so the very Portuguese nation comes from these Arab origins. And as a result, new Arabs from Syria and Lebanon are somehow actually connected to Portugal in these fantasies of hierarchies and imagining the desirability and suitability of immigrants for Brazilian society, and therefore also presented in a positive light. Now, I want to move on to point four and talk about state and nationalist reactions in Argentina to immigration. Up until now, I've been focusing on Brazilian fantasies about immigrants, so the arrival, the successful arrival of millions of people, and then how Brazilian elites talk about the benefits of the arrival of these people, and zooming in on, in particular, Japanese and Arabic speakers. Well, I want to shift gears briefly and talk about some more negative reactions to immigration. And there's a similar history here in Brazil and elsewhere in the Americas, the disconnect between those fantasies of why they need immigration and then these fears about immigrants once in Brazilian, or in this case, Argentine society. So Argentina, like Brazil, has a very strong desire to Europeanize or to import European immigrants to transform the society. There's a 19th century Argentine thinker who writes that an important influential sort of author of the Argentine Constitution in the mid-19th century, who writes that immigration is a means to progress, so that national progress and national success depends on immigration from Europe. But that idea of a hardworking white European immigrant comes into conflict with other ideas about immigrants, namely that they will be sort of politically subversive, that they're bringing subversive ideas of anarchism and socialism and communism to Argentine society, that they are overly demanding in the labor movement, and that the importation of these very same European workers are actually undermining Argentine labor practices and sort of social order, because they are bringing these negative, radical, transformative ideas about work to the Argentine working class, or what's increasingly becoming the Argentine working class. So a key element of these concerns over immigration, though, is immigrant bodies as these subversive elements that will undermine the making of a cohesive Argentine nation. And so in this sense, in the late 19th century, the Argentine government takes a number of steps to counter what government elites or government officials and politicians see as the downside of immigration, and as a way to sort of continue immigration, but then control it through state regulation. So one is that Argentina becomes the fourth country in the Americas after the United States, Canada, and Uruguay, but this happens all around almost the same time. In 1884, the Argentine government passes a law on obligatory education, so the children of immigrants will go through a public school system and sort of be then have ideas of national belonging and political order imposed on them. So this is sort of another idea of how they can deal with immigration. There is an affirmation of citizenship law in 1888, and this is what now is the norm. You can also find this in Canada or the United States. If you're born in a country, you become a citizen of that country. In 1850, that was not necessarily a sure thing in many parts of Latin America. And there's this conference in the 1880s to kind of working out the details. Should you be the citizen of the country of birth, or the citizen of the country of your parents' birth or parents' ethnicity? And so there's this law, citizenship law, which makes anyone born in Argentina an Argentine. So again, trying to sort of impose a political subjectivity onto the children of immigrants as a way to maintain a social order and to prevent any sort of subversive influence of the cultural pluralism of Argentine society. There's all sorts of other national so commemorations have become increasingly important in Argentine society. So beginning in the 1880s, there's a commemoration of Argentine independence from the early 19th century. There's the prominent use of the national anthem starting in the 1880s, and the rise of military parades and culture, all of which takes place in the 1880s. So directly in the moment of increasing rates of immigration, there's all these sort of symbolic acts of political belonging that start to emerge in Argentine society at the same time. And this is very much a nationalist reaction to the cultural pluralism that mass migration is increasingly bringing to Argentine society. I want to give you two examples of how the Argentine state and Argentine officials talked about these policies that I just sort of outlined, and I want to zoom in on education. So, for example, in 1888, the Minister of Education for the country, Benjamin Soria, so he and I share a name, Benjamin Soria, he writes, and I will read briefly from this quotation, "Argentina is a country that accumulates and assimilates diverse elements and incorporates them into national life. We will teach in our schools and put in our curriculum the knowledge indispensable for all Argentine citizens. This will accentuate our character and, as such, give cohesion to the nation." So very much spelling out here with in talking about the role of education, what I'm talking about, what I've been just speaking about, the concerns about the diversity brought by immigration, and the state intervention to counter that diversity through, in this case, education policy. To give you one more example, another minister of education 20 years later in 1910, José María Ramos Mejía, a very prominent person in Argentine politics in this time period, writes, and I quote, "The power of the state to harness the people and achieve their unity and strength resides, as I have said before, in the school. It is here that we can find the necessary strength to melt and amalgamate the different races that are constantly flooding the country." So if you reflect on both of these primary documents, there's a very similar tone of sort of concern about immigration. So Ramos Mejía speaks about the different races that are constantly flooding the country. But in both cases, they talk about, and again, to quote Ramos Mejía, the power of the state to harness the people and achieve their unity through schooling. And this is a nationalist reaction, the implementation of a school system in response to mass migration. So I want to move on to my conclusions and sum up the points I've just made. So first, Argentina and Brazil were transformed by immigration between 1880 and 1930. And I'm saying Argentina and Brazil were transformed in a way that a lot of other parts of Latin America weren't. Argentina and Brazil are the destinations in Latin America. They are the destinations in the Americas alongside Canada and the United States for mass migration in the late 19th and early 20th century. These two countries were transformed demographically. Their population booms in this time period, largely because of immigration. Their economies are growing in importance in this time period. And then as a result, there's this lasting legacy in national identities in both countries because of this transformative era and this transformative era and the fact that now a very large portion of the population today descends from this moment of mass migration. Now, concerns about the kind of immigrants that would come to the country shaped Argentine nationalism, and in many ways, nationalist projects that emerged in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in Argentina were in response to migration. In Brazil, you can find similar stories of a nationalist reaction, but something also particular about Brazil and unlike Argentina is the connections between the end of slavery and the rise of mass migration that they sort of overlapped in terms of decades. That slavery starts to end with gradual emancipation in the 1870s, just as immigration is picking up. So the arrival of non-European and non-African peoples from the Middle East and Japan, in this very context of the end of slavery and the rise of European immigration, gets mixed up in these debates, these discussions of how immigration will transform the black-white binary or transform a slave society, or how it will not transform a slave society. And then groups of non-European and non-African immigrants to Brazil, particularly Japanese and Middle Easterners, get mixed up in these national discussions, and the outcome of which is they're seen in a positive light and something that, like Europeans, will also transform Brazilian society.